I would like first to introduce Senator Paul Lektor, who is the chairman for the United States. He is a senator from Nevada. Senator? In Governor Ronald Reagan, we have a man who always tells it like it is. And we are delighted that he is here to bring his message to us. Governor Reagan opposes détente, as we now know it. He opposes the growth of the welfare state as it is now operated. And he opposes the ever-expanding federal bureaucracy. If you read your morning paper, there was a big headline that said that in February, the increase in prices was the lowest in a long period of time. If you read your paper yesterday, you noticed that the federal debt went up $32 billion. The federal debt now stands at $627 billion. I understand what $500 billion is, but I don't know what $632 billion are. I would like to make just one other comment, and that is that when Governor Reagan was elected governor of California, and he served that state in a very magnificent way for 8 years, the state was fiscally, bankrupt. When the governor finished his term, he left them with a surplus in excess of $500 million. The thing that we need in this country, and we have needed it for a long time, and we're at a point in our history, if we don't get it now, then we are going to be dragged further down the road with much of the same things that we've had essentially for the last 40, 45, or 50 years. We believe that Governor Reagan has the leadership ability, the dynamic spiritual motivation to get this job done. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to join me in giving a great Eastern North Carolina welcome to the man who is our candidate for the presidency of the United States, Governor Ronald Reagan.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for a very warm and gracious introduction. My fellow guests here on the platform, and you, ladies and gentlemen, I hope my fellow Republicans, and always I hope a goodly gathering of Democrats who want something better out of life. You see, I can say that because I spent most of my life as a Democrat, and then switched over when I found I could no longer follow the leadership of that party. But I still believe that the millions of rank-and-file patriotic Democrats in this country are as much in disagreement with that leadership as evidenced in this very irresponsible Congress as I am. And maybe one day we'll all get together. Now, maybe you're surprised after all the events of yesterday that I'm still here and in the campaign. Well, although the Washington establishment doesn't think so, this primary election system of ours, long and imperfect though it is still, I believe, one of the best instruments the people have to express themselves. Now, on the eve of the North Carolina primary, there are those who would deprive you of the chance to vote for something different in Washington. They don't really want an election next week. Yesterday, some mayors who support Mr. Ford were persuaded to call on me to withdraw from the campaign. And then some governors. yesterday afternoon in a broadcast interview in Washington, Mr. Ford delivered a not-so-well-disguised invitation for me to withdraw from the campaign. Well, I am touched by their concern for my welfare. But I can't help but feel that they sound a little nervous about their own. They sound a little confused, too, because here it is only the day after. And now Washington says, well, it didn't talk to those mayors, didn't know anything about them. And your governor says that he talked the whole thing over with the campaign people in Washington, but they say they haven't talked to anyone in North Carolina. And Mr. Ford, who wishes the invitation on television, is now doing an instant replay now that he's arrived here in North Carolina. He says he didn't say it. Well, I guarantee you, I didn't say it. Well, just to calm them all down and to put their minds at rest, as the American general said at the Battle of the Bulge when the Germans asked him to surrender, nuts. I am in this campaign to stay and to win. I hope that you people in North Carolina will not let yourselves be intimidated by the Washington establishment. Only one ninth of the delegates to our convention have been selected so far. Now, in baseball, you don't call the game at the end of the first of the nine innings because one team has a slight lead. So far, almost half the members of the Republican Party, 45%, have indicated their support of my candidacy. We are doing better in votes and in delegates than our own projections before this race started. And I am in the race all the way to Kansas City because I believe I offer a better chance for our party to win in November than does my opponent. Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, said that a man can be loyal to his government and still disagree with the policies of those in power. Well, I do disagree with a number of the policies in power. For example, I disagree with a policy in Washington where neither the administration nor the Congress is fighting inflation as they should be fighting it. Today, this country is $95 billion deeper in debt than it was 1 year ago today. As a matter of fact, it took our country 166 years until the middle of World War II to accumulate a total debt of $95 billion. Now we increase it, $95 billion every 12 months, and the debt is some $600 billion. You and I at least can do one thing for our children and our children's children who are going to have to pay for this debt. At least let us set a pattern. And before we leave the scene and the stage of history, let us start by balancing the budget and starting to make payments to reduce that national debt. And when I say there are disagreements in policy, I didn't disagree at the very beginning when Mr. Ford started a program of fighting inflation. You remember the win buttons. I don't know what happened to them. They disappeared very swiftly. And the first thing you know, he had told us, and you remember on television, he drew a line on a chart of the budget, and he said, I will not allow the budget, the deficit, to go over $60 billion. And in a very few short months, he was before us fighting recession, not fighting inflation, and asking us for a tax cut and saying that we could accept a budget deficit of somewhere around $70 billion. And now we're told that the deficit is going to be somewhere around $80 billion. But ladies and gentlemen, you may be asking, why does an $80 billion budget or a $60 billion budget add $95 billion to the debt? Well, I'll tell you why. They play tricks with the bookkeeping. They always use the term the budget deficit. But what you and I aren't told is that they shove a number of programs outside the budget. The post office is no longer in the budget. And so they don't have to count the deficits that are being piled up there. They just quietly accrue to the size of the national debt. Well, when we fight recession, of course we want an end to recession. We want an end to unemployment. But what causes both? Inflation. And what causes inflation? The federal government spending more money than the federal government takes in, and it's not going to be stopped until we balance the budget. Now, balancing the budget is hard, but not impossible. It's like protecting your virtue. You have to learn to say no. But not too long ago, Mr. Ford came forth with a new plan. He would go for a $28 billion tax cut. That was to be bait for us. Everyone wants a tax cut. But we want an honest tax cut because the cost of government has gone down. And he wanted $28 billion cut, but it was to be matched by a $28 billion cut in the proposed budget. I had a question then, and I have a question now. If there was $28 billion in the proposed budget that could be cut, what was it doing there in the first place? That's a little like a merchant. You know, the fellow that tells you he's going to have a sale 20% off, but he raised the price 40% before he cut the 20%. I am in disagreement with the energy policy. It's going on 3 years now since we lined up at the gas stations. Couldn't get gas for our cars. 500,000 American working men laid off and lost their jobs because of industries that couldn't get fuel oil to continue in operation. We were only buying 14% of our oil from the Arab nations at the time, and look what it did to our country with the oil embargo. Well, now, today, the president has signed the energy legislation spawned by an irresponsible Congress, and today, just 3 years later, we are importing 40% of our oil. What happens if they embargo us now? We literally grind to a halt in this country. We are producing less oil now. After all the promises that we'd become independent of outside oil, we are producing less oil than we were 3 years ago. And last week, for the first time in our nation's history, we imported more oil than we produced in this country. I disagree when the president says that he wants to preserve the integrity of Social Security. I disagree with one word. I want to restore the integrity of Social Security. Because that program is financially out of balance right now. The other day, a very elderly gentleman came up to me. He said he wanted to be for me. But he said many people today who are dependent on Social Security are disturbed because we are being told, he said, that if you become president, you will destroy Social Security. Well, I don't know by they've been told by whom. I'm not telling them. And I'm kind of surprised that the other side is telling them, because all the way through New Hampshire, they had a fella taping everything I said, and all they have to do is play that. Maybe they erased 18 minutes. But I can tell you where I stand on Social Security when I say restore its integrity. I believe there should be a presidential commission appointed not of the bureaucrats who got us in trouble in the first place, but of private citizens, experts in the field of insurance and pensions and actuarial statistics, given a commission to put that program on a sound basis, but at the same time given an order that in the reform they propose, there must be a guarantee that those depending on Social Security and those looking forward to it in the years ahead will continue to receive their payments, and their payments will keep pace with the cost of living, which they have not done up till now. While they're doing it, I think there are a couple of other reforms we could put into Social Security. The women in this country, working wives particularly, are discriminated against by the entire program, and that should be corrected. And one other correction. If we're going to call it insurance, if a senior citizen reaches retirement age, is entitled to receive his benefits, but wants to continue working for a while, he ought to be able to do so without losing his benefits. I am disturbed by something else of a different nature. Some something that I believe shows that this nation is in great danger, and the danger grows greater every day. We hear that the new slogan is not going to be detente. We're not going to use the word, but the policy remains the same. Well, the policy has been a one-way street by which the Soviet Union has been advancing its aims at our expense. Now they talk of peace through strength. But Secretary of Defense Schlesinger a short time ago tried to tell the American people about our strength, tell us the truth, and I believe that's why he's no longer a member of the administration. He was trying to tell us there is no strength. Certainly not the strength kind of strength we've known ever since World War II. The Soviet army is double the size of ours. Their reserves are four times the size of ours. Their navy has twice as many ships and submarines as we do. Their artillery outnumbers us 3-1, and their tanks outnumber us 4-1. Their nuclear missiles are bigger, more powerful, and more numerous than ours. We are not dealing from strength. We are making concessions to the Soviet Union, not in return for a concession from them, but in the hope that they will smile and treat us more gently now that they're ahead. I believe in the peace of which Mr. Ford talks, but I don't believe you get peace through weakness. I don't believe you get it by making concessions. I believe you have peace and can only have it when we restore the military supremacy of the United States so that no other nation on earth will dare attack us or challenge us. While we're talking foreign policy, I have disagreed for more than a year with a policy that has seen our government relaxing the trade bans on Castro's Cuba, urging the Organization of American States to do the same thing. And as we butter up to Mr. Castro, he is exporting revolution and now has 12,000 mercenaries interfering with the activities of the newly emerging states in Africa. It seems to me, and Mr. Ford just recently, in spite of this policy, journeyed to Florida prior to the primary, in the area where lives the greatest number of Cuban American refugees, and told them that he now recognizes Castro as an international outlaw and will never recognize him. I will believe that when the United States asks the rest of the free world and the rest of the American states to quarantine Castro's Cuba until he brings those 12,000 mercenaries home and stops exporting revolution. I am in disagreement with a foreign policy that sees, as we stand here today, negotiations continuing down in Panama to give away the Panama Canal and the Panama Canal Zone to a military dictator, a friend of Castro named General Omar Torrijos, who overthrew the duly elected government of Panama 8 years ago, has allowed no elections since, no civil liberties, and censors the press. He has threatened that he will sabotage the canal and that he will start guerrilla warfare, as he calls it, a second Vietnam against the canal zone unless we return the canal zone to Panama. The negotiations continue, and Juan Tack, the foreign minister, the counterpart of Dr. Kissinger in Panama, has made a statement to the press that he has the assurance of the President of the United States that we have already agreed to a preliminary treaty to turn over the canal zone to them. The canal zone, ladies and gentlemen, is sovereign United States territory. It is every bit as much sovereign territory as is the state of Alaska. And I think it is time for us to tell Mr. Torrijos that we're not yielding to his blackmail, that we bought the place, we paid for it, we built it, and we darn well intend to keep it. Now there's another issue that's been raised in this campaign, an issue that says that there are no differences between the candidates. And the inference is, therefore, we should preserve the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. Well, I say there are great differences between us, and one of the greatest is our relative approach to government. I believe that this has been determined by our previous experience in government work. Mr. Ford was a congressman for 25 years. He represented his district well, but for 25 years, his interest had to be the welfare of a single congressional district. Then he was appointed vice president by Richard Nixon, and 19 months ago stepped into the White House. I have not had that long experience in government, but my 8 years were spent as governor of a state, which, if it were a nation, would today be the seventh-ranking economic power in the world. But as your chairman told you, that nation, that state, was on the verge of bankruptcy, spending $1 to $1.5 million a day more than it was taking in. I didn't know whether I'd been elected governor or appointed receiver. California was just about in the same condition as New York City. And New York City, the only difference between it and Washington, Washington has a printing press. The teacher's retirement fund in California was an unfunded $4 billion liability hanging over every property owner in the state. The Great Water Project was unfinished and underfunded by $500 million. The entire year's budget for Medicaid had been spent by my predecessor in the first 6 months of the year before we got there. And so we knew that we had to turn to the people for a tax increase. I didn't like that because I thought the taxes were already too high, just as I think they're already too high nationally, with governments, federal, state, and local, taking 44 cents out of every dollar we earn. But I told the people of California that I consider the increase temporary, and as soon as we could, we'd give the money back. And then perhaps where the difference lies between us. As President, Mr. Ford has revealed his faith because of his previous existence as a part of the Washington establishment. He has turned to the people of that establishment. His appointments have been of former members of Congress, of former bureaucrats and department heads and officials of that establishment, to all the high positions to which he can make appointments. I don't happen to believe that those who have for a long time been associated with the problems have necessarily proven that they're the best able to solve them. When I became governor, I thought of myself not as a part of government. I never had aspired to government position. I'm not quite sure yet how it all came about. But there I was, and I thought of myself as a citizen, temporarily in government to represent the people against government. And I turned to the people for the kind that I could appoint who would feel the same as I did. I did not accept the applications of those who wanted jobs in government. I sought out people whose arms had to be twisted, who would give up a few years from their own careers and activities to serve for a time in government to help do what I wanted to do. I asked for people who would be the first to tell me their job was unnecessary if they could find out it was. And we gathered that kind of a team in Sacramento. There was a reason behind it. You know, Dr. Parkinson has written in his book that government hires a rat catcher, and the first thing you know, he's become a rodent control officer. We had a team, and for 8 years, we kept that attitude. For 8 years, among ourselves, we said to each other, when we begin talking about government as we instead of they, we've been here too long. I think that attitude is needed desperately in Washington, D.C. right now. I believe that what was done in California, because, well, let me go on. One other thing we turned to the people for, I almost left out, the most important thing. After we had our team together, we went back to the people. We gathered together in a group like this, the most expert people in their particular specialties that could be found in California. And we asked them to volunteer, offered them nothing. They received no pay, no expense to the taxpayer. More than 250 volunteered to come into government, organized into task forces based on their specialty, go into every agency and department of state government and come back and tell us how modern business practices could be put to work to make government more responsive to the people. They gave 117 days apiece full time away from their own jobs and careers. They came back with 1,800 specific recommendations. We implemented more than 1,600 of those. And the result was that a little over a year ago, I turned over the administration to the new incoming government, and as the chairman has told you, they were the first new administration to be handed a balanced budget in California in a quarter of a century. We handed them a $500 million surplus. The teacher's retirement fund is fully funded on a sound actuarial basis. The water project is completed with $165 million left over. Our bonds have a rating of AAA, the highest credit rating you can get. And we kept our pledge to the taxpayers. We returned to them in rebates and refunds $5.761 billion. What was done in California can be done at the national level if someone will ask the people to help. You'll remember Lyndon Johnson tried to have a great society, but he tried to have it by government edict and government regulation. Only a great people can make a great society. And have we forgotten that we are a great people? We built this country. We opened the West without an area redevelopment plan. We built our cities without urban renewal. And I know that today in Washington, that elite that breathes the mist off the Potomac, they don't think the American people have the courage anymore to face the truth. So they don't tell us the extent of the problems. They don't tell us that we're number two in strength. They don't tell us that the energy situation or the domestic problems. Well, I happen to believe and think that it is time to turn to the people of this country, to tell the people of this country the truth about their problems and tell it all the way from the White House, and then ask the help of the people in solving those problems and get the bureaucrats out of the way so the people can get them solved. Every time Washington tries to do what the people should do for themselves, it's a failure, a very costly failure. 20 years ago, they set out to have a housing program. They were going to build low-cost housing. They've torn down 3.5 houses for every one they've built. Education. We now have federal aid and federal control of education, and the quality of education has declined all over the country. We built the greatest school system the world has ever seen, and we built it at the local level, and it should be turned back for control and administration to the local level. You've got an example here in North Carolina of what the federal government can do. Gaston County. Last year, they had a worthwhile project, $21,000 from the federal government to buy oil for the people who were too poor in that county to buy fuel oil to keep their houses warm in the winter. $21,000, and now we find that $20,500 of it was spent on administrator salaries and expenses, and only $500 bought oil. They bought 268 gallons, and they're now trying to find out what happened to 128 of those, because nobody knows what happened to them or where they went, how they were used. The greatest example of Washington's failure is welfare. There's no one in Washington that knows how many people there are on welfare. They only know how many checks they're sending out. In Chicago, they found out how many checks they're sending out to one woman. She's been using 80 names, 30 addresses, 15 telephone numbers, and been getting $150,000 a year tax-free from welfare. Now they're charging her with fraud. But the legalized fraud is even worse, and we found that out in California. We found we had 194 full-time county employees in one county on welfare at the same time. And some of them were welfare caseworkers, and they were acting as caseworkers for each other. We were increasing the caseload 40,000 people a month. We went to the people again, not to the bureaucrats. They're still trying to come up with a reform plan in Washington. The only thing they've come up with so far would add 12 million people more to welfare instantly. Well, in California, our Citizens Task Force handed us the most comprehensive plan for welfare reform ever attempted. We put it into operation. In 3 years, we weren't increasing the caseload 40,000 a month. We reduced the roll by more than 300,000 people. We saved the taxpayers $2 billion, and we were able to increase the grants to the truly needy and the deserving, the elderly, the disabled, and those who had to have our help by an average of 43%. I believe that welfare should be turned back to the states and the local communities for authority and administration, and with it should be turned back the tax sources the federal government is using to pay for it. And may I tell you of a very successful experiment. able-bodied welfare recipients should work at useful community projects in return for their welfare grants. A further difference, Mr. Ford says that he believes he should be re-elected, because he hasn't been elected yet, but elected, in order to have a continuity of government in Washington. Do you really want to continue what's been going on in Washington? Well, that's the way I feel about it. I think it's time for a change. Now, the question has been raised also as to who can win, who offers the best chance for victory next November. When I made the decision finally to run, my principal consideration was how it might affect our chances for victory in that election. I hope next Tuesday, before you go to the polls, that you will ask yourself some questions that I think have a very important bearing on this primary. Our party, the Republican Party, has been a party of fiscal responsibility. For 40 years, we've opposed the profligate tax and tax, spend and elect policies of our opponents. How do we campaign next fall if the Democrats can point to our candidate as having presided over the greatest budget deficit in the nation's history? In these 19 months, fully one-fourth of the national debt has been accumulated. The Republicans in Congress representing us oppose the Democratic efforts to cut defense spending. How will we respond in the campaign if the Democrats are able to point out that under our candidate's leadership, we have become second to the Soviet Union in military strength? Mr. Ford and Dr. Kissinger have objected to my criticism of their foreign policy. The Democrats will criticize it next fall. How will we defend the befriending of Castro while he exports revolution? How will we defend his making of Cuba a Soviet satellite? How can we defend the giveaway of the Panama Canal? How can we criticize the disastrous energy legislation passed by the Democratic Congress if our candidate is the man who signed it into law? How do we defend the candidate who fired Secretary Schlesinger, who has said that he will retain Dr. Kissinger, and if I am elected, I will appoint a new Secretary of State? And how do we campaign for a change in Washington under those conditions, for a reduction of the bureaucracy, for the elimination of the blizzard of paperwork that harasses the shopkeeper, the farmer, and the industry, and the businessman? How do we cut back on regulations that are stifling the freedom of competition in the marketplace when these things have grown worse under the direction of that particular candidate? I gave this the consideration in making my decision, and I will tell you now, I would not be standing here asking for your vote and your support if I did not believe in my heart that I offer us the best opportunity we have for victory next November. I'm not a part of the Washington establishment. I have no ties. I have no bonds of friendship or a long-time association to prevent me from doing the things that I believe have to be done to dismantle that bureaucracy and reduce government to size. Now, I've said enough. It's been too much, maybe. But rather than go on with the monologue, in a little bit of time that is left to us here, I probably can't hear anything from way back, but maybe we could have a little bit of dialogue and some of the points I might not have touched on. Would you like to answer? Yes, sir. Ask some questions. What is my stand on religion? Well, maybe I understand what you mean. I had breakfast a few days ago in Chicago with a good North Carolinian, Billy Graham, and we were talking about, both of us, and our agreement on the need in this country and the hunger of the people in this country for a spiritual revival. I'll leave that mainly to him. But my own personal viewpoint is this, if that's what you're asking. I couldn't have done the job. It's inconceivable that anyone could have tried to do the job for 8 years in California or attempt to do the job ahead that I am seeking if I didn't believe that I could turn to God for help when I need it. What about financing the world? Well, I think there is a legitimate area of foreign aid. I we've been doing it wisely, but I think that we need, as the leader of the free world, which I hope we'll continue to be, that we need to help those other free nations, our allies, so that we can stand together. And the number of free nations are decreasing every year as more and more nations peel off and see that maybe they better throw in their lot with the Soviet Union instead of with us. I think we've been unwise in the help. I think we've violated the old biblical adage. You know, if you give a hungry man a fish, he'll be hungry tomorrow. If you teach him how to fish, he'll never be hungry again, and we should be using our money to teach him how to fish. How can I help a small independent merchant? Well, for one thing, the small independent merchants in this country right now spend 130 million man-hours a year filling out required government paperwork that costs and adds $50 billion a year to the cost of doing business, all of which we pay in the price of the product of necessity. I think government should have a great bonfire with a lot of that paper for the bicentennial and get off your back for the regulations of the harassment. You know, the regulations are so ridiculous. I just have to tell you one thing. You know that 25 years ago, the Hoover Commission found out that Washington files a million reports a year just reporting there's nothing to report. Now, yes, ma'am. Oh. How do I feel toward veterans programs? Well, I think some Americans before us, one of them was Calvin Coolidge, but one even way back in the Founding Fathers, I think, expressed it very well. The nation that forgets its defenders will itself soon be forgotten. Yes, sir. How do I stand on policing the world? Well, maybe this touches on the Angola situation. I think the problem has been not that we want to police the world, but we want to preserve the free world, and we are the leader of the free world. And I think the difficulty is that our government, a long time ago, back in the Vietnam War and even before, stopped telling the American people the facts about our national security and the world strategy. In the Angolan conflict, here was the administration asking that we should go over and help, and here was Congress saying no, and you and I, the people of this country, were left up in the air because no one told us, was Angola or is Angola important to our national security? If it is, then we the people would decide to do something about it because it's our safety that's at stake. If it isn't important to our national security, who cares? But I think it isn't just a case of being a do-gooder around the world. It is time that the American people were told the nature of the chess game we're in. That the Soviet Union is progressing steadily toward its aim that it has never sacrificed or given up. The aim that one day they will dominate the world with a one-world communist state. We, in turn, should be told by our country if there are spots that are important to us, and you and I think, would agree that we should be involved. If they're not important to us, then we walk away from them. And we've got to be told the facts. The protection of the environment. Well, now, here, hate to boast again, but California has been ruled by the federal government as probably being out ahead of the whole nation in our efforts to preserve the beauty of our state and the environment, and certainly you should be interested because all of us in our cars motorcading around the state here when we don't fly someplace have been remarking about the beauty of this state. But I think that it's a very simple problem. I think sometimes we've let some people panic us into very unwise moves. People are ecology, too. We've got to have a place to work, and we've got to have a place to live. And I think what the most of us have to do is there are two groups of extremists. Over here are some people that would pave over the New River and pave over everything else in the name of progress. Over here are some people that wouldn't let you build a house unless it looked like a bird's nest. Someplace in between, there's got to be room for common sense. And I think that this is the path. We do our best to preserve the environment. We move forward in the protection of clean air and clean water, preserve the beauty spots.
again, as I say, we recognize people must have jobs. People must be employed. We've done some very foolish things. For example, you take the devices on the automobiles now that are supposed to clean out the oxides of nitrogen that turn the air brown in what we call smog. Well, now, after spending all the billions of dollars, we learned that if we could stop all the emission of oxides of nitrogen caused by man, we would only reduce them by 7%, because 93% of the oxides of nitrogen are produced by nature. The same thing is almost true in the same figures with sulfur dioxide in the air. I think we should use a little more common sense and not be stampeded as we have by some people. But all of us agree that we want to preserve the beauty of this country. Sir, since you asked, may I take some others here first, because I know time is limited. Yes, ma'am. $5 million to find which way the fish swim in the river and so forth. The scientific research. A congressional committee recently discovered there's $4 billion worth of subsidized research by the federal government. And they found the people in charge don't know where it is, what's being done, how many projects there are. And can I tell you about one that's my favorite? You just mentioned one. They've had a study that's called the Demography of Happiness. And they learned that young people are happier than old people. They learned that people who earn more are happier than people who earn less. And well people are happier than sick people. $249,000 to find out it's better to be young, rich, and healthy than old, poor, and sick. Senator Chevron, I'll take the lady right in front of me because I've been kind of overweight on men here so far today. What do I think about lowering the age limit on Social Security? I'm not sure about the lowering of the age. I think that we've come along to the place today where maybe we've not only extended the lifespan of people, we've extended the ability of people. I'm not saying that we should suddenly delay it and make it longer, but what I said goes earlier, that when you get there, if you want to keep on working, you ought to be able to. But that's right, yes. I'm in disagreement with a lot of the forced retirement rules. But I'll tell you what concerns me more than Social Security. The federal employees took themselves out of Social Security. Maybe they knew about that imbalance before we did. They're not in it, but they got a retirement program that they can retire at 55. And then they retire on a pension, which you and I pay. Then they can get a job in the private enterprise sector, work for a minimum period, and then they're eligible for Social Security also. And they get both the pension and they get Social Security, too. That's one of the reasons why I think if Social Security recipients want to keep on working, they ought to be allowed to do so. I know. Wait a minute. May I just say the one thing here? The question was to please hear it, and I will quit. I'll go away. But I just want to say, when it comes to age, I know part of the question had to do with people that want to keep on working and so forth, the companies that won't hire and all this. You know, it does seem as if just about the time you learn the rules, they tell you you're too old to play the game. And I think we ought to remember that a fellow named Stradivari built the first Stradivarius violin, the greatest violins in the world. He built the first one when he was 60 years old. Verdi wrote the opera Falstaff when he was 80. And England's greatest statesman, Gladstone, never became the greatest statesman until he was 83 years old. So maybe we should change our thinking a little bit. Now, let me just say, I can't take any more questions, but let me just finish by telling you this. Up in New Hampshire, a little six-year-old girl asked me a question, and she kind of threw me, and I didn't give her a very good answer. I'd heard the question from adults, and it didn't throw me, but coming from her, how do you answer a little six-year-old girl who says, why do you want to be president? And I tried, you know, all the things about bureaucracy and the things I've said here, turning government back to the state and local levels and so forth. And it was only after I left that I thought of what the answer should be. All I had to say was what I really feel in my heart. I do want to be president. I want to go to Washington. I want your help and the people's help, because I'm